For me, a lot of learning agility is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. And it's being able to apply lessons that you've learned in a previous experience to a new situation.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Hello, and welcome to the Learn It All podcast. Today, if you are interested in learning and leadership, then you want to stick around because today we have a president and CEO of multi-billion dollar companies with up to tens of thousands of people who specializes in transformation and large-scale turnarounds, in part by leveraging the power of learning leadership. We are Damon Lemby, CEO of Learn It, Darren Bridget, Chief Learning Architect at Learn It, and we are joined today by Elias Simpson. Elias, thank you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited for the conversation with you both.
Yeah. Well, so that was a pretty quick little introduction. Could you maybe give our listeners a little bit more background on your story?
Yeah, absolutely. So Elias Simpson, most recently I was president of Motive Care, which is a Fortune 1000 company that specializes in healthcare services, the largest of which is transportation, providing transportation for those who need it to healthcare appointments, supplemental benefits, also in-home care, as well as remote patient monitoring. So $3 billion business, and I ran about the $2 billion of that as president. Prior to that, I was CEO of BPost North America, which is the Belgian Postal Service owns a bunch of businesses in the U.S. and Australia, the largest of which is a company called Radial. So I was CEO of that business reporting into Belgium. But we worked with large brands. Like if you've ever ordered from Dick's Sporting Goods or Estee Lauder or something like that, Radial helps get those products to you. So yeah, so I have a long background in logistics, operations. I actually started my career in manufacturing post the military. Just kind of worked my way up. Literally started out as a warehouse supervisor when I was 24 years old and eventually worked my way up to leading plants and buildings and eventually regions to where I was a global CEO. So,
Elias, well, thank you so much for being here today. Now, I'm not fantastic at math, but doing the math, it looks like from about 10 years after leaving the military, you were in a senior leadership role. And about 12 years from leaving the military, about a dozen years, you have accelerated to becoming a CEO and president. How are you able to move through that trajectory so fast?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, David. You know, for me, part of it was just having some really good sponsors along the way and some folks who really showed me the way. So that was definitely part of it. And then also it was very intentional. Early in my career, I fell in love with operations and with building teams. You know, I went to work for Halliburton and they introduced me to lean and operational excellence. And it was the first time of me kind of leading a large team. I had about 37 warehouse employees that reported to me and I just fell in love with it. And, at that point I thought, you know what, I want to, you know, I had a great boss named Mary Beck at the time who was over all of our supply chain and procurement. And, I was like, you know what, I want to be like Mary one day. I want to lead supply chain. And little did I know that I would eventually not only, get to that director level, but eventually get to that VP level. But every time I made a step up, I just was even more inspired to go further. And then, for me, as I got a little bit closer to seeing that executive level and experiencing it, I think primarily towards Cintas when I was working there, but they had a CEO at the time named Philip Holloman, who really inspired me. And I thought, I think I could be an executive someday. So I started to kind of look into what it took and, follow those examples and just worked really hard at it and had a lot of good people working with me and to help me get there. So yeah, but it's been quite a quite a journey. I think I got my first CEO job at 36 or 37, and that was a, over $1 billion business, as we discussed. So that was pretty pretty exciting.
I want to take it back a little bit to your beginning with sports and the military. But before I do so, one of the things I talk about quite a bit is imposter syndrome. And when you came in as a CEO at 36, did you deal with any imposter syndrome?
Oh, absolutely. Say,
if I was a CEO at 36, I would have been an imposter.
No, listen, during the day, but this is a true story. When they called me up, you know, so the first they called me to tell me that, you know, they're going to make me CEO, the board's decided and all this stuff. And they're planning all the press releases and everything that need to be done. And our head of media relations calls me out of Belgium, and he's like, hey, we just want to make sure we have that you're okay with the fact that we want to put your age in the press release. They're like, it's pretty common that when we announce a new CEO that we put the person's age. And I'm like, oh man, you know, like I said, again, this is, you know, I think I was 36, 37, and I was so self-conscious about it. And I was just like, you sure you have to do it? And I'm like, I think that's going to look bad. And they're like, no, it's going to look great. And I'm like, oh, so absolutely dealing with imposter syndrome. Here I am, this young guy coming from, young black guy at that, coming from where I come from. I'm not supposed to be here. So absolutely, I battled with that. But it was really cool to see how others, what I saw as something to be insecure and self-conscious about, others saw as this huge accomplishment that I should be proud of. And so it eventually helped me to recognize that it's not something to be self-conscious about, that I was a young CEO is actually something to be very, very proud of and to take some pride in, and also that to you know, inspire me to want to do a good job to show that it wasn't just age. You know, I think experience definitely matters, but if you have the right skill set and talent, you know, sometimes you can perform despite maybe being young.
I have to imagine that that's exactly one of those kinds of things that you learned how to do as a leader for other people, which is to help them see what a perceived weakness as a strength. It's absolutely. Like how you shift people's focus is kind of is so much of what it means to be a leader, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you know, something I learned in my career in terms of, you know, how you inspire others is that everybody finds inspiration in different ways. And I think where a lot of leaders go wrong is they think about what inspires them and they try to use that to inspire others. But not everybody's inspired by the same thing. So some people are inspired by achieving something that's never been achieved. Some people are inspired by helping others. Some people are inspired by money. Some people are inspired by, you know, rewards and recognition. And it's really important that you understand what inspires people and you're able to connect to that and help them find their inspiration. Because that's the other thing, is that the inspiration has to be primarily intrinsic, right? That motivation. And it's really just helping them find it. You can't really put it in them, right? You can just help them see what it is that motivates them and inspires them and help guide them in that direction. And then they take off. It's amazing what you can accomplish if you just believe, right? Like belief is such a big deal.
Absolutely. And in a little bit of my research, I heard you talking about people agility. And that's pretty much what you're speaking about right here, right? Yeah. Is getting... being self-aware and also, I guess, being curious as far as what inspires people, because everybody's different in how that works.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly right. I think, you know, the beauty of what we've seen out of a lot of the DEI movements and things is that we're learning what it means to treat everybody like an individual, right? And that is definitely a key to leadership, is everybody is unique, right? Everybody's their own individual, and what makes them happy, what makes them sad, what inspires them is different. And so I think being able to, you know, good leaders can recognize that, and they can figure out how to inspire and motivate people. And I think when you're really talented at it, you can figure out how to take 5, 10 individuals, 10,000 in the case of some of my roles, and get them all inspired in different ways, but to do the same thing, right? And it's you know, if you think about, you know, and Damon, you know, I'm going to go to sports, right? Like, if you think about sports, the different guys on the team have different motivations. Some people want to win a championship. Some people want to make the all-star team. Some people want to make a ton of money. But the best coaches can figure out how I'm going to make sure everybody's getting what they want and inspired to what they want, but for the same goal, which is to, you know, be a successful team. So for me, you know, being able to find the individual inspiration, but then make it about a team and team goals is when you really nail it as a leader.
There's so much there. It's hard to stay on track, but I'm gonna believe it already, because there's so many things to talk about with you: the people agility, the learning agility, the inspiration. Yeah. You've written and spoken very eloquently about diversity and Black experience in particular, and we want to get to all that stuff. But to give our listeners some context, let's start kind of with some seminal experiences for you. For example, you've talked about moving a lot when you were a kid. Division I football and the military. Yeah. How did some of these things set you up to be the kind of leader that you are?
Yeah, no, that's a great question there. And I think, you know, I've had to reflect on that a lot, right? Because, you know, I try to think about what were those experiences that helped shape me, good and bad. You know, they're different things. And I think, you know, I grew up a military kid. You know, My father had some issues my biological father had some issues when I was young, and my mom joined the military to take care of me and my brothers. So she was a single mother, and we traveled, and I went to 16 different schools as a kid. I only went to the same school 2 years in a row twice in my entire childhood. But I think for me, what that showed me is that, you know, I would move from Georgia to Colorado, for example, and what was, you know, popular or cool in Georgia was not popular or cool in Colorado. And so, you know, very early on, I learned that people are all different, right? People are all different, and what, you know, what may get you success in one place doesn't necessarily get you success in another place. But that was good and bad for me, because it made me adaptable, but it also, you know, I didn't get stuck being one way or thinking one way, because I was moving around. And you know, I think it really helped me on the learning agility front, even in sports, right? Like in sports, I had to learn a new play calling system every year because I was playing for different coaches, right? They all had different ideas of what was important, what was good. And so as an athlete, I was constantly adjusting as well. And in turn, what that made for was I was a really versatile athlete, which worked against me in some ways, because they're always like, what position should you play? But you know, as you get to better coaches and you get to that D1 level, as you mentioned, they figure out a way to take a good athlete and make that person successful. So so for me, that adaptability and that versatility that I was required to have just based on the way I grew up really became an asset in sports, and how I was able to learn a new play calling system, able to adjust, how I was able to get along with different teammates. But then as I, you know, entered the professional world in terms of how I'm able to, you know, go from one company to the next and still get along with people, or how I'm able to enter a new relationship with a customer and immediately find something that we can connect on and in some way to relate to that person, definitely comes from doing that over and over again at an early age. So
yeah, I mean, we share the same experience with playing Division I sports when, absolutely. And I've heard you say before that it's kind of like a full-time job, you know, absolutely. I mean, it's around the clock and it's like a full-time job. But one up that you have on me for sure is that not only did you play sports, but you joined the Air Force Reserves after your freshman year in high school, I mean, college, right?
Yeah.
And would you say that, so you have between sports and military, what helped mold more your leadership?
That's always tough, right? Because I think I have so much of both of those. By the way, Damon, you were much more successful than I was in sports, but that's a whole other topic.
Glory days.
But I think for me, I'm always trying to understand, am I more military, am I more sports? I think what I've done is I've taken a lot of the positives from both and applied them. I mean, I've taken a lot of the areas that I see as opportunities in both as well. And I can give you some examples of that. You know, I think the military is very structured, right? And they because of how the military works, whether you go to a base in Kansas or a base in Texas, things are going to be similar. And so what the military does really well at scale is, you know, training and development. Like, you know, they send, you know, millions of soldiers through training every year, and all these soldiers are learning the same thing. Everybody's buying into the same value system. everybody's on the same page and they can do this at scale and they can replicate things at scale. And there's a lot of discipline and a lot of accountability in the military. And those things are things that I take very, very seriously, as well as integrity, right? Like one of the things that, you know, if you look at the Air Force values, it's service before self, integrity. These are things that I carry with me from a business perspective. What I don't carry with me from the military is the military is very big on chain of command, right? Like it's not okay to, you know, talk to somebody who's above your boss, or it's not okay to go outside in terms of promotional opportunities and things like that. It's not about who performs the best. It's about who's been there the longest, who's, you know, different things like that. So for me, there's a lot of positives that I take from the military, but then I see those other aspects and I'm able to say, okay, how can I take these positives, but then maybe solve for some of the other things that could be frustrating in the business world or civilian world. And then sports, the same thing, right? Like one of the big things I learned about sports, and believe it or not, I didn't really learn it until I was on the executive team for the first time, is that, you know, we grew up playing sports, folks like David and I grew up playing sports. And so we just assume everybody knows what teamwork looks like. And the reality of it is a lot of people have never been a part of a team. And then even those who maybe have been a part of a team, they've maybe never been a part of a high performing team. And so if you don't understand what it means to play a role on a team for that, and to sacrifice for your teammates and for yourself so that your team can be successful, that may be innate to me or seem innate to me and to Damon, that's not innate to everybody. And so how do you in the business world apply some of those things that are really important in the sports world in terms of being a successful team? And the other thing I take from the sports world is that, and I tell people this all the time, you know, if you take very direct and immediate feedback in sports, right? Like if you're at the plate, Damon, and you strike out, you immediately know you failed, and your coach is going to tell you immediately what you did wrong. And it's up to you to then course correct and get better. So that, you know, sports has very candid feedback and very immediate feedback, but that's what allows people to get better. And so I think that oftentimes in business, we don't think about the fact that when something goes wrong, we all need to immediately figure out what happened. And it's not about blame, right? Like your coach is never saying to you, Damon, hey, we lost this game because you struck out. They're trying to help you get better for the next time. But it's not from a blame perspective. It's from a let me help you perspective. And then they expect you to help yourself in that. And so I've been known to be, you know, very much about feedback and transparent feedback in both ways, right? Because Damon, as you experience, when you get to that Division I level, the feedback goes both ways. Like sometimes you go to the coach and you say, hey, you had me in the wrong spot. Mm-hmm. Like, and I couldn't make the play because you told me to go here and I needed to be there, right? That may not fly in Pee-wee, but that you can do that when you're playing Division I or definitely pro baseball. So that's the other thing I apply to the business world is I expect my team, especially my executive team, to tell me if we're going the wrong direction or if I'm not helping them to be successful. And I'm going to do the same thing. And as a result, we're going to have a high level of accountability and we're going to be a high performing team.
I love all you said right there. One thing for me was sports. You know, I played for 3 Hall of Fame coaches and you learned this from military. But my first baseball coach, Andy Lopez at Pepperdine, one of his two rules, one was show up on time. There's, you know, if you don't show up on time, you're late. Number two was have integrity, do the right thing and do the right thing all the time. And people are like, well, what does that mean? You know what that means. So it's important to have integrity. But I'm sure you feel the same way. I've learned a lot of great things from some of these great coaches, but I've also learned what not to do as a coach, as a leader. I mean, I had one coach, doesn't matter who it is a big league manager right now though. Kind of like you said, when things went well, Elias, great. Everything's great. He put himself out in front. When things didn't go well, there were times like, well, how are we going to win when our cleanup hitter is striking out, which was by me, by the way. Right. And so that's one thing I always told myself was that as a leader, I'm going to own the mistakes and the failures and kind of be vulnerable out there and share with people, hey, I messed this up, you know, because then I think when you do that, people feel more comfortable to be able to give you direct feedback and want to help instead of getting, you know, defensive about it. So there's great things you can learn back and forth. And one of the, I guess, moving into the learning agility topic, when somebody asks me what learning agility is, I say almost exactly what you said. If I was up to bat and I struck out, I need to immediately get some kind of feedback from my coaches, but I needed to be able to learn and adapt for next time. Absolutely. You know, and you have to do that in real time. You don't have the luxury of waiting. You know, you have an at bat coming up in 15 minutes or so. Those are all great things. How do you define learning agility?
No, I think you're spot on. Well, I think first of all, learning agility is one of my favorite topics, and I think it's probably one of the most underrated and overlooked aspects of someone who's going to be successful in leadership, but also just in any role, right? And for me, I think of a lot of learning agility is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do, and it's being able to apply lessons that you've learned in a previous experience to a new situation. And so, you know, I think about, if I use a sports example, a lot of athletes play multiple sports, right? And so, you know, maybe you've been, a perfect example, I was on the golf course the other day, and we were talking about the golf swing and my swing needs some work, right? And one of the people I was playing with was like, well, you didn't grow up playing golf, so the swing isn't as natural to you. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, did you ever play baseball? And I was like, yeah, I played some baseball. And they were like, well, aim, try to hit a grounder in a second. That's how you hit this shot. I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, it's this ability to take a different situation and apply it to something new. And for me in my career, I've done that a lot, right? Like I've done, like I mentioned earlier, I got a lot of lean and operational excellence training early in my career. And there was a lot around the Toyota Production System and other things that I learned. And I was immediately able to start taking lessons around operational efficiency and apply them to other areas, right? And as I grew in my career and started to manage other parts of the business, HR, sales, other areas, I would see that things that maybe worked on the manufacturing floor, the same principles could apply in the field for sales, right? And, mm-hmm. You have to be able to kind of adjust the situation and adjust the scenario for those involved. But that ability to take what you've learned in one situation and apply it to another is just so critical. And even if I just think about going back to what we discussed earlier, my background of going to multiple schools, right? Like I know how to meet new people, right? And that experience of being in a room full of new faces for the first time as a 8-year-old, when I go into a executive meeting with a new customer for the first time, I'm able to take all those times that I've done that in the past and apply it to this new situation and say, okay, how do I immediately break the ice? How do I immediately, build a relationship with these folks? So, So for me, learning agility is definitely just taking what you've learned in a prior situation or scenario and being able to apply it to new situations and scenarios for your benefit.
As soon as you mentioned golf, I immediately grabbed and I accidentally dropped, so we call it the double club, which is like the 3-wood, which is supposed to be one of the hardest to hit. Yeah. I immediately want to talk to you about golf because there's something about you, because I would want to anyway, but also you bring a lot of curiosity. I mean, the experience you had as a kid moving up with 16 different schools, by the way, quick shout out to your mom. My mom was a single mom who put, raised us on food stamps and stuff. And like, thank God for moms. Right. You learned to trust yourself, in that environment. I think a lot of people don't. Right. And you learned to kind of trust yourself in new environments, and you're bringing that trust and that curiosity, which is what allows you to have that versatility and that agility. So to just be honest, part of your success is a very hard thing to teach or quantify, which is charisma. And that's kind of how you get charisma. And I'm going to embarrass you right now, but I don't care. I'll go for it. You're a charismatic guy, but I think because of those things, it's that curiosity and that trust, and you're willing to come into new environment. I mean, what allowed you to develop that kind of mindset instead of kind of going in the opposite direction and feeling kind of beat up by all those experiences?
Yeah, it's funny. My wife and I talk about it, and I just have this this belief in myself, for one. You know, I think my favorite movie as a kid was Rocky IV, right? And you know, I like Rocky III and Rocky IV and the underdog story. But, you know, I was very love those movies, right? And you know, I think as a child, I was very aware that my circumstances weren't ideal, and I didn't look at that as a reason to give up. I looked at that as a motivation to do better and help myself get out of that situation. And so every time, you know, I failed at something, I just thought to myself, okay, how can I do better? But I also just had this really deep belief that I could figure things out, right? And I had a really strong belief in myself. That was, you know, I would tell myself, hey, I'm gonna figure out how to do this. You know, even in sports, I was not, believe it or not, I was not the most talented athlete growing up. But I was the hardest working kid in the weight room, and I was putting in the extra hours, and you know, so that the work ethic was definitely there. And I think a lot of that came from seeing my mom do what she did to make sure that we were taken care of. And just always believe that, hey, if you put in the work, it'll pay off, right? And I was one of those people that just bought into this idea. And I used to literally say, tell it to people all the time, hard work always pays off. Like that's something I believe. I think that if you know, again, me and my wife were talking about it the other day, and I told her, I was like, listen, you know, there's not many people, there's probably not anybody in the NFL who doesn't love football, right? Yeah. And when you love something, you'll work hard at it. And that hard work will eventually pay off. And it pays off in different ways. But I think oftentimes, you know, people think that's cliche or whatever, and they'll say, well, I worked hard at something and it didn't pay off. And it's like, you probably didn't do the right work, or you probably don't know what hard work really looks like, right? And, you know, when you see the guys who, you know, get up at 4 a.m. on their own to lift weights and go do hitting drills or, you know, footwork drills or whatever, you realize that there's a different level of hard work. And I applied a lot of that to my business side as well, because, you know, while I was working, I was doing other things. Like you mentioned, David, I joined the Air Force while I was in college, right? And that was a lot of work. Like other kids went home and had fun for the summer. I went and did military drills, right? And then, you know, went back and got my MBA while I was, you know, I had young kids and went to school at night. And I was a senior vice president traveling all over the world. And I went to live classes at night to get the MBA. So I think there's an element of hard work that not everybody understands, but if you're willing to put in the work, it will eventually.
I just want to say very quickly, Damon, when Rocky first came out, because I'm old, I got up in the morning and had the raw eggs and like tried to jump. But it did not translate into the same kind of sports career as you guys. So,
right.
You know, sometimes I think talent is also a little bit
hard. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it helps that God made me 6'4". So,
talent helps. But Elias, you know, you and I have young kids, right? We have young kids, and I grew up with a work ethic because I just saw different background, of course. I was very lucky, but I really wanted to prove myself that it wasn't just handed to me from my parents, right? So, and I think me and my siblings all roll up our sleeves and did that. But now here we are. We're pretty successful. And it's a different generations, different times. I guess my question to you is, how do we learn to embed this work ethic in our kids coming up? I mean, because to me, that's the most important. You know what I mean? I mean, I just want them. I want Wally and Lucy to don't worry about getting perfect scores, but let's just freaking work hard.
Yeah, you know, I think about that all the time, and it's what you said is spot on too, though, and I think it actually points to our earlier conversation where, you know, even though you and I have different backgrounds, we were able to find our inspiration and our motivation, right? And so, once you found that and you were like, listen, I don't want anybody to feel like things were handed to me, then you put in the work because you now had something to motivate you and inspire you. And I think that's what it is we have to find in our children and, you know, the next generation is, okay, how do we find what it is that inspires you and motivates you and makes you want to do something more different, right? So it's a challenge, but I think the only way you can do it is to just really be open-minded, right? Like you have to just really be open-minded. You have to communicate. You know, I like to ask a lot of like really open-ended deep questions to people and questions that maybe like catch them off guard, you know? And, you know, and then I also believe that, you know, I always tell the kids how good they are at things, even if they're not really that good. And you know, that might sound counterintuitive in some ways, because it's like, well, how are you motivating if you tell them they're good at something, they're not going to work hard at it. And the reality of it is that, at that age, you know, all four of my kids are under 10. At that age, the recognition from dad motivates them. Right. And so, you know, they'll eventually figure out what it is they love, but they'll be motivated to try new things and give their best because they love that recognition from dad of saying, oh, you're so smart, or oh, you're so fast, or oh, you're so strong. Right. And yeah. That I'm building in belief. And I'll give an example of my son, who's six, and, you know, I always let him beat me in arm wrestling. So he thinks he's incredibly strong. Right. And, but I tell my wife, I'm like, hey, I'm only going to let him beat me until he's seven. And then I'm going to show him that he's not actually stronger than me. And so like, for me, my thought process in that is that I want him to be motivated and to feel good about being strong and to care about it. And he now cares about it. He now tells everybody how strong he is. He now always wants to do it. And then eventually he's going to realize that, wait, I'm not really stronger than dad. So if I want to be strong, I have to work for it. Right. And the hope there is that he's found the passion for being strong, and then he loves it. And then now he'll put in the work to actually be strong as a result.
Elias, in a big organization, and you've had, you know, tens of thousands of people before, how do you handle inspiration? I mean, at that level, you want to be an inspiring leader. Do you prefer to do it more, you know, one-on-one on a big stage? What are the tricks that you could, or the tips that you could offer to folks when it comes to being a kind of an inspirational leader?
Yeah. I like doing both. I think they're both very different though. Right. And, you know, one thing that's common amongst both is that it has to be genuine. You know, for me, I try to be very genuine. I try to just be myself. And I do that whether it's in front of, you know, 10,000 people or whether it's one-on-one with one of my direct reports. I'm going to be myself, and I'm going to be pretty transparent. And I'm going to try to be relatable, right? I think that it's very hard to be inspired by someone you can't relate to, right? Like, you know, if the person who's, you know, telling you, yeah, hey, here's what we got to do and let's go get it, and you're looking at this person thinking like, yeah, but you and I don't have anything in common, or we don't, you know, we don't relate. Like, why would I listen to you? Right. And so I think being relatable is really important. And I think the easiest way to be relatable is to be genuine and to show that you care, and to show that you care about people, right? And that you care about the people that you're charged with, you know, leading or working with. And I think once people see that you care, you know, you guys know the old saying, right? Nobody cares what you know until they know how much you care. You know, I think I prefer love precedes leadership, right? Like I tell people all the time, if you don't genuinely like people, leadership probably isn't where you should be. Because, you know, because for me, leadership is all about inspiring, directing, and providing a vision for people and taking care of those people, right? And, you know, you hear the term servant leadership all the time. And really what that means is that, you know, you want to serve others. And in that desire to serve others, you end up leading them, right? And, you know, that's definitely the way I think about it is I love to see people be successful. I love to see people achieve things that they didn't know that they could achieve. I love to see people come together as a team, people do things for the first time, you know, that person that gets that first promotion or meets that metric for the first time or gets that first hit on the baseball field, right? Whatever it may be, I love to see people, you know, achieve whatever it is they're trying to achieve. And again, it's not about them achieving what I want them to achieve. If that's the approach that I take, then they're not going to be inspired because there needs to be some intrinsic motivation. So it's about helping them achieve what it is that they want to achieve. And when people can see that in you, they'll follow.
Yeah. It's there's really strong themes through everything that you're saying. And I think underpinning a lot of that too is that belief in people. I love that you even said, you know, love. You have to genuinely care about people and focus on people first. I think that genuine part is a big deal too. But you combine that because I think people get like they hear that, but then they struggle to make it real for them. Like they struggle to execute on it. And I think part of that is that accountability piece. Yeah. You had mentioned earlier about giving feedback. And that can be difficult, especially today. You know, in the US, we put a real big premium on self-esteem and people have even invested a lot of energy in trying to be more aware of other people, more empathic. And it's almost shut them down more. So they're like afraid to be direct, afraid to give direct, honest feedback and hold each other accountable. How do you balance these two things?
Yeah, no, I think you know, there's a lot to that, but I think you actually there's a couple famous sayings around it and coming from different places, business. There's some religious sayings around it, but really when you care about people, again, like I said, you're charged with taking care of them. So I tell my teams all the time that if I'm not willing to tell you directly what it is that you need to work on or how you need to get better, do I really care about you? Right? Like you stop your kid from running in the street because you don't want them to get hit by a car. And sometimes you have to, you know, yell because they start to run in the street. And so you have to yell and grab them. Now you don't yell at people at work. That's not what I'm saying. But my point is that to your child, they may not always understand why you don't want them on their phone past a certain time or why they can't just play video games all day or why they need to go to school. But it's, you know, or why you're correcting a bad behavior, right? But the reality of it is that as their parent, you're responsible for putting a successful individual out there into the world. And to do that, you have to give them feedback. And so the same thing applies in business, that if you're my, you know, chief sales officer or you're my, you know, forklift driver and you want to do a good job. So again, it doesn't matter whether you're an executive or whether you're, you know, front line, I have to tell you whether or not you're doing things right. And if that's coming from a place of, I care about you and I want you to be successful, I think people can tell. Darren, now what I'll tell you is, anytime you give people criticism, it hurts them initially, right? Mm-hmm. There's an ego element and a pride element that we all have that when someone tells you you need to do something different, it's an immediate shock. And I think being aware of that in the moment, and so being able to balance the conversation or the feedback, knowing that, hey, I'm probably going to say something that this person's not going to love hearing. So I'm going to immediately need to be able to explain why I'm telling them this and why it's important. And so that why behind it really matters. And the example I give all the time is I had a person who was working for me as like a general manager or director at the time. And they were struggling with some things and the client was giving me some feedback and I could see that there were some issues with the financials. And the reality of it is that this person needed some help with the P&L, but really it was math driven. Like they just weren't comfortable with some of the math. And so, you know, here I am as an adult talking to another adult saying, hey, you know what? You should think about taking some math classes, you know, at a local college or something because you really need to get better at math. And, you know, I remember telling my HR person I was going to have this conversation, like you can't tell somebody they need to get better at math. Like, yeah. I'm like, I don't tell them they need to get better at math. They're never going to learn the financials. And, you know, fast forward. And now this person's a vice president. They run a very large P&L and, you know, they're having a huge career. And they did exactly what I suggested. They went back and got better at some of the math elements of that are required to manage the financials of a business. So, you know, it wasn't an easy conversation, but I made sure that he knew where it was coming from and that it was coming from a place of, I'm trying to help you be the best version of what you want to be, not the best version of what I need you to be. This is what you're telling me you want to do. Well, I'm telling you that if that's what you want to be, here's the things that you're going to need to do to get there. And I'm going to support you in any way I can process. So,
and that even falls into, and they're always really difficult conversations, But that even falls into sometimes when you have to let people go. Because a lot of times people who get to the point to let go, they're miserable in their career and they're miserable in their job. And what I've told a lot of the leaders that are both clients of ours and internally at LearnIt, you're actually doing them a favor if you do it the right way. If you communicate to them what's going on and give them an opportunity to go find something else, you know, something that's more of a strength for them, you know, it's something that they can do better at in the future. And that kind of leads me into a little bit, you're a big strength finder guy, right? Is your approach to leadership, and this is kind of the way I look at it, for me, I've always been about, I think you get a greater impact out of working on people's strengths than on their weaknesses.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Damon. I think, and first, before I get into that, just to come back to your previous point, also as a leader, if someone's not happy or not performing, you owe it to the rest of the team to address.
100%. 100%.
And so there's this, you know, going back to the accountability piece, Darren, if you don't see me holding Damon accountable, then how do you expect, you know, how do you respect me as a leader, right? And so I think there's that element into it as well. But I'm definitely a person who believes that you figure out what people's strengths are and you allow them to focus on their strengths. I'm not saying that you don't work on weaknesses. I don't think that that's 100% accurate, that you just ignore weaknesses. I think everybody should be constantly working to get better. But the reality of it is that people do have strengths and weaknesses, and there's no Superman or Superwoman out there. And so for most people, they're going to be really comfortable and really good at certain things. And going back to what I said about football, you don't make it to the NFL if you don't love football. And so in business, I'm not going to put somebody who hates numbers in finance because they're just not going to do, they're not going to do well. And if you love numbers, I'm going to put you in finance because you're going to work harder and be more intrinsically motivated doing something you love than something you don't enjoy. And if you've read the book Strength Finders, you talk about it all the time. But when you're doing things you're not good at, you typically don't enjoy it, right? And you know, Darren, going back to the golf example, I tell people I want to be good, just good enough at golf that I can go play, but not so good that I care when I play bad.
Right? I need to reverse my trajectory to get back to that because I care too much when I play bad.
Right. And so, you know, that's true in business, right? Like people need to be able to find enough enjoyment to want to work at it. And if they're not good at it, they're not going to enjoy it. So I'm definitely big on strengths versus weaknesses. But I think you also, as you progress in your career, and if you do want to be an executive, you're not allowed to have as many glaring weaknesses, right? Like that's just a reality of the situation. And so as you progress, you do need to strengthen those areas of weakness a little more. Again, you know, certain things are never going to be everybody's strength, but you do need to know where your weaknesses are and either figure out how to supplement them or work on them, but focus on your strengths and put yourself in a position where your strengths can shine. So
along with strengths, and I want to make sure that we get this in, Darren and I talked, along with strengths is workforce is the importance of diversity. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk a little bit about diversity and how that really can positively impact work environment.
Yeah.
You've read so eloquently about this before. It's really, and I know you have some good recommendations about how to work towards, as you said, working towards a more equal future.
Right. Yeah. And
what are those keys to creating exposure for people?
Yeah. I think that, you know, first of all, the reason it's important is that the diverse perspectives really help, right? And it really, you know, two people don't approach a situation in the same way in a lot of cases, right? Now, and the reason diversity becomes important is because oftentimes if you have too many people of the same background with the same experiences, they are going to approach that problem in a similar way. And so, you know, again, if you look at the three of us, we all have different experiences. We all have different backgrounds. Yes, we have things that we have in common, you know, and, you know, again, Damon and I are both athletes, et cetera, but we approach things from a different perspective. And so problems often can be solved in different ways, but oftentimes there's a best way to solve a problem too. And, you know, sometimes my way isn't going to be the best way, and I'm going to need Damon's way, or I'm going to need Darren's way. Sometimes it's good to have somebody who's less competitive than Damon or I looking at this problem, because that competitive side of us maybe focuses too much on winning. And we need somebody who's maybe more focused on the experience, or who's more focused on the people or whatever, right? So having those diverse perspectives matters. And I think, also when you have diversity of background, it creates an environment where people interact differently, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a different, you avoid the groupthink, right? Mm-hmm. And people have to be more aware. And I think that's a good thing, right? Like it's a good thing when you have to be aware of how your leadership or how your presence even in the way you go about things is impacting others. And I think that self-awareness is heightened in a situation where you're around people who are different from you, because those differences stand out, which make you more self-aware. And that self-awareness helps you to be a better leader. Because if you can just go through life without being self-aware, it's a disservice to yourself, right? Like you don't realize the things that you don't know, or the things that you don't see, or the things you're missing out on. And so bringing that diversity together forces everybody in that situation to be more self-aware, which allows everybody to focus more on their strengths and weaknesses and the areas that they need to be doing better and need to be doing different. And then as a group, you become self-aware of the group dynamic. Yeah. And now we know as a team where our strengths and weaknesses are, and who should be stepping up to do this. And Damon knows this, right? Like, you know, on a baseball team, if it's a pinch runner situation, who you're putting in there to do the pinch running. It's the same in business, right? And you've got to have a feel for your team and know who's good at what, and be able to say, you know what, in this situation, we need our best listener. In this situation, we need our most inspiring person. In this situation, we need our numbers person. And, you know, having a diverse team will allow you to be able to leverage your team and put different people at the forefront in different scenarios. So it's to me, and then there's research shows, it's you're always going to have a more productive, high performing team when you have a diverse team.
It's interesting what you're saying, because it's that research, right? That a diverse team has more potential than a team that's just all the same people, right? But that you have to kind of do the things you've been talking about, and we've been talking about, in terms of having that good communication, that good sort of genuine connection in order to get to achieve your potential. Right. And then you call that another element, which is, because that idea is that then you're better than just the best person on your team. Collectively, you're better.
Absolutely.
But you're saying it also makes you individually better, because absolutely, it brings more self-awareness and more exposure by having diversity around you, which is really cool.
Darren, when has being more self-aware ever been a bad thing?
If you think about
your career, whether it be whether it be sports or business or whatever, being self-aware is typically a good thing. And again, you become more self-aware in certain environments, and sometimes environments that are uncomfortable can make you more self-aware.
It's funny you bring that up. So just quickly, because as an actor, this is a big deal, right? Because what I always talk about, it's almost like mentioning, like, just how you use words, but being self-conscious can shut you down. But self-awareness means you're just aware, and you're kind of accepting, and you're fluid, and you're in the flow. But you know, it is also possible to become so sort of self-conscious, especially when you're a leader and you're up in the public eye, that it starts to shut you down.
I don't think you can be a great leader if you don't have a strong level of self-awareness. I mean, I think that's whenever I'm out talking to our customers, or even the people I mentor, I mean, you have to, and it's kind of incredible to me, some people who aren't. It really is, you know, and so I just think it's so important, you know, that people are able to kind of reflect back. And I think that has to deal in with exactly what you're talking about people agility. You have to have self-awareness to be able to, because I think, you know, I think one nice thing people say about me is you could drop Damon in pretty much any room and he can survive. He could just adapt and get along, because you can't have the same types of conversations. You can't go the straight route to every single person you're talking to. You kind of want to adjust in that room, whether it's with a client, a coworker, or whatever, to really how they communicate and, you know, what's going to be interesting, you know, for them. And I always try to just be a better listener and ask more questions. You know, it's better when you're more curious than the one who's doing all the talking anyway.
Yeah. And to your point, like that is self-awareness, right? And understanding how you come off to other people even, right? And, you know, for me, I've had to really think about that and understand that, like, okay, you know, being self-aware, I know when I need to step up versus when I need to step back. I know when people need to see me being very confident. I know when people need to see that I'm concerned. And so there's this element of, you know, when you're a CEO and a president, people are watching everything you do, right?
Everything.
And so, you know, being self-aware to say, okay, I know things, like, for example, things are going, you know, something goes wrong. Everybody's going to look to see how I react. And if I panic, everybody else is going to panic. But if I show confidence and I show, hey, yep, this happened, it was not good, but here's why we're going to be okay, everybody kind of relaxes and they're like, oh, okay. And some leaders aren't self-aware in that way. And they'll, you know, something goes wrong and they lose it. And they're, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. And they're, and then all that does is everybody else is now following this person and being like, oh my goodness, like it's, you know, it's no different than if we all turned on the news tonight and the president came on and said, everybody run, it's going down, like we'd all be we'd be freaking out, right? And so yeah. that self-awareness that people are watching you and that you know, your voice matters, especially as a CEO, like that was one thing I learned as a CEO, is how much what you say matter to the people within the organization. Being self-aware is so critical, and it can be one of those things that helps break barriers in terms of inspiration and relatability.
Yeah, I've seen some pretty large companies where the CEO, maybe in a moment of upset, send out terrible emails, you know, panic emails, placing blame emails, and it really crushes the morale and the motivation of the people in the organization. Plus, it turns it almost into sometimes like a yes organization where people, you know, I mean, I'm thinking of one of a, you know, couple thousand employee company where people are afraid to be anything but a yes person because they don't want, you know, like you said, when you don't have diversity, you can't get diversity, right? Because
Absolutely. It's either
going to be that person's way or the highway for them. You know?
I think to Darren's point, right? Like when the fear comes into play, that's what can change from self-aware to self-conscious, right? Like if you people start to feel that fear, that people will shut down, right? And it's hard to be confident making decisions. It's hard to be comfortable being creative. If I'm in an organization where I feel fear, I'm just going to try to do what I think you want me to do, not what I think I should do. And if you think about it, the last thing you really want as a, like, you know, the last thing you want as an individual is to just always do what somebody else wants you to do versus feeling like, okay, I'm in this role and now I can do the things that I know I should do, or, you know, I know my voice matters or my innovation matters, that creativity, that feeling of ownership over my role is important. So,
Those situations are so crazy because so often the person that's in charge, they don't really know because nobody's going to tell them, you know, they're in their own bubble, just thinking everything's okay. Yeah. It's why I think it's so important as a leader to really actively get that. And you can't just ask for it. I've seen leaders like really genuinely, I want feedback, but if you know it's not safe, you better not give them feedback. So it's like, it has to be real. It just, everything really has to be real. Speaking of real, I know we're getting close to time here. So people have gotten to learn a lot of new things about you throughout this podcast. And we like to ask their signature question. What is something that maybe people don't know about you? Something a little surprising. Just something that a lot of people don't know about you.
Oh, man. Yeah. So I think the thing people probably don't know is that I'm gonna say the one that my wife always says is she's like, people have no idea how like simple I am and some of the things that I'll do to like entertain her or the kids, you know, like I'll put on the sport coat and go to the office and lead a town hall, but then I'll get home and I'll, you know, wear matching pajamas with the kids or do a cartwheel into the swimming pool. And I love to cook. I read the books and I do all the voices when I read them children's books.
Nice.
So I think that would be the thing that people would be surprised to see is that, you know, I like simplicity and and that I can really kind of be silly and do goofy things with my family and friends.
So next time you're on the show, we'll all wear pajamas.
Yeah, there you go. I love to put the kids in like matching pajamas. It's just something that I find really really entertaining for whatever reason.
I love that.
They know I like it.
So. Yeah, I think that's super fun. And it's fun to see dad do that, coming home with the suit and then getting into pajamas. It makes you feel special as a kid.
Yeah. I never walk into a swimming pool. That's the other thing that my wife will tell you. If I'm getting in the pool, I'm jumping in the pool.
Make a splash. Yeah,
always.
I mean, that's what I love, Elias. You made me think of my dad, who, you know, I lost 13 years ago to cancer. I would see him up in front of all the shareholders, you know, in large rooms doing talks and speeches and in front of his team, and a very powerful guy and, you know, very motivational. But at home, he was just like a little kid, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was just like a little kid and so silly with us all the time, you know. Yeah. And absolutely. It was just made, that's one of the things that just made me so proud of him all the time was like, so thanks for sharing that.
A little bit of humor in the workforce, in the workplace, can be good too, especially if it's coming from like a generous place. You got to bring humor.
You guys have seen that before, where they talk about one of the most common traits amongst successful CEOs, amongst a bunch of things, is a sense of humor, right? And I definitely, if we can't have fun at work, and we're just taking ourselves super seriously all the time, that is not the environment that I'm ever going to be a part of, right?
Yeah,
We want to work hard, but we want to have fun.
Elias, this has been a fabulous conversation. And the big takeaways for me is to take all that different experience in your life and turn it into something positive by nurturing it to develop that kind of curious, versatile, agile personality and be genuine with it. You know, because that as a leader, that's how you combine the best of everything and how you actually can get accountability into the workforce and then start to leverage the power of diversity and things like that. Yeah. And I think you just embody that almost as much as the words that come out of your mouth. It's just embodying what does that feel like. So thank you for that.
I appreciate that.
Awesome. And so, Elias, as we wrap up, I think more people need to learn about your leadership style and everything. Where can people connect with you at?
Yeah, well, definitely on LinkedIn. You know, I'm pretty active there, and I like to connect with people. You know, it's actually a bad habit of mine that if people reach out and they want to talk or connect or try to learn something, or if they need help, I'm always there to help. So that's where I would start, is definitely trying to connect with me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. So, other than that, I'm sure I'll be leading another large company here in the near future, and looking for new faces to inspire and lead.
And I hope one of these days I'm able to read your book, because I'm sure it'll be a great one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's coming. It's coming.
I'm going to keep you accountable to it.
Yeah, I have a few ideas on titles, so I'll run them by you.
Well, thank you. I mean, this has been an incredible conversation. We could have sat here for another hour, 2 hours, talking about leadership in areas, but it's been wonderful for our audience. And for our listeners out there, if you've enjoyed this episode, please like it, subscribe to the Learn It All podcast. And as we like to say, stay curious and keep learning. For now, everybody, that's it. Have a good day. Bye.
Thank you both for having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.